Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Commander Cast, Season 3, Episode 13.
Yeah! Let's get it!
Hey everybody, what's going on? This is Commander Cast, the weekly EDH / Commander podcast about community, strategy, and technology, available every week at mtgcast.com, quietspeculation.com, and of course our home site, commandercast.blogspot.com, soon to be commandercast.com. So be sure, like, bookmark that now, because when the next season drops, it's all going to be going down over there. We're going to have the website with the articles, with the videos, with the podcast. We're going to have all kinds of new content going over there. So again, commandercast.com. I really want to stress that now and get out of the way. But now that I've mentioned it, let's move on to introductions. My name is Andy, a.k.a. Ghost. That's with three O's and plural all over the internet. I'm the podcast director and producer. Locally, I'm a league organizer. In the real, I am a casual Magic scrub. I'm not terribly interested in the technical aspects of the game. I have no real desire to get better at it, but I do enjoy playing it. And I do the technical side of the podcast, so that's more or less why I'm here. But to handle the side that's actual content, I have Donovan, Carlos, and Byron with me, who are all three, like, Commander Cast OGs for the season finale. And we also realize we are the ABCD of Commander Cast. Yep, I'm a fucking dork. So, Byron, why don't you introduce yourself?
Yeah, as long as we're going in alphabetical order. All right, yeah. My name is Byron. I go by Surging Chaos online, everywhere. I'm the more fairly competitive player on this podcast when it comes to Commander. I like playing monocolor decks, and I also like playing some obscure cards, and I also like toolboxes, and to sum it up, I'm your typical Commander player.
Alright, okay, I guess we're going in alphabetical order now.
Let's keep this rolling alphabetic-wise.
Alright, I'm Carlos. I write about Commander on Quiet Speculation every Tuesday. I write about deck building and deck tuning, based on different kinds of constrictions, like budget and things like that. And I play Commander mostly because it's the most wide-open format where you can do kind of whatever you want and all kinds of absurd things happen.
And my name's Donovan, a.k.a. Dosu, but you can call me D-Money.
Yes. Dude, and I encourage everyone to do that, especially like on the street. In front.
I have never heard that.
Yeah. Yo, like, D-Money! You know, see how that goes over.
But no, yeah, I'm basically
it's too late
just
now. There's no closing the door on that, D-Money. That's how it goes down from here on out.
I guess we'll just have to live with it. But I've been diving headfirst into building like some Pauper EDH decks, and I'm pretty excited about it. I don't have much time recently, but hopefully that'll clear up soon.
I hope so as well, because another thing involving CommanderCast.com is that once we move to that site, Donovan will be the new co-administrator. So you'll be seeing a lot of the updates being posted by him. He'll be managing a lot of the content, and basically he'll be running the website with me. It'll be probably a little upside towards me doing more work at first, but then eventually I'm kind of hoping to transition into 50-50 split, and then maybe we can get more underlings and just pawn everything off, and then we can just sit atop a glorious pile of internet money that has no meaning anywhere, because I've never made a dime off this joint. But, okay, so that's out of the way with introductions. Last couple things I want to touch on. I mentioned that we've kind of been keeping track of entourages that people have actually made. Entourages is a segment where we take an underplayed general, and we build a skeleton for the deck. And the first one resulted in the birth of the Ib Nation. Ib Half-Heart, Ib Nation Stand Up. And that's been kind of stunningly popular. I've seen a few at conventions now. A lot of people have said that we kind of inspired them to build an Ib Half-Heart deck. So that's pretty awesome. But our later segments didn't seem to have quite the same level of success. So Imshan, who was on the call-in show and will be doing writing for Commander Cast next season, has actually constructed a Cheese A deck. I have played against it, and like for a Cheese A deck, it's kind of mean.
It's cheesy. That is a straight up pun.
Okay.
We're so clever here.
Pun! Okay, so yeah, it is straight up cheesy. So Cheese A, yeah, it's a surprisingly good deck. There will be a link in the show notes, and as well, Cassidy from TCGplayer.com and one of my main mans, and John, who is a listener that emailed us, both kind of took up the challenge of building a Celestial Kieran deck after the challenge about that one on the Mono White episode. So we'll have links to both those. Good looking out to you guys for building those. They both actually look really good and totally playable, whereas we've still haven't heard anything about Course of the Conclave. So that's the only one that's kind of sitting out in the cold. If you build one, let us know, because I would like to feature those. I kind of like to do follow-ups on those. And then one last email I got was from Mike, a very interesting variant on Commander that he mentioned after the Pauper cast, Turkish Prison EDH. Yes, that's
this sounds awesome.
Well, anything involving turkey is good, and then anything involving prison, doubly good. Come on, D-Money, you must know about that. So, that's where he got his tear tattoo. In Turkish prison EDH, the only real rule, other than the fact that there are no rules, is that all of the cards in your deck, none of them can cost more than 25 cents. So it's like super popper. Like, if anything costs over 25 cents, it's too classy for prison. You have to agree on a price point, setting place, obviously, I suppose, a vendor of your choice. And then if a card's value goes up for some reason, then you say it kind of bought its way out of the joint, and you have to take it out of your decks and replace it with something else. Oh, yeah, Jeremiah mentioned this to me once, and he said that his kill condition in his deck was, like, training drone. So that should give you some unique insight into the horrible world of prison EDH. So there's another format if you're really into the popper thing and you don't like spending money. Turkish prison EDH. Just drop it to your friends maybe sometime and like at a dinner party. Oh yeah, I was playing this Turkish prison game the other day. And just see how it goes over at that classy dinner party. But that's it for the introduction. So we're going to move into community now. We're going to be talking about something I know Byron's probably want to talk about forever. And we've always kind of flirted around on the show. So we're just going to tackle it head on. We're going to do the Kokoshu case on the free-for-all roundtable.
We are now to our community segment, and we are finally going to get to actually talking about Kokusho the Evening Star. And we've never actually talked about this on the show. We're finally going to get to, like, should this card be unbanned finally, or should it stay banned forever? And those of you who don't know me, I have been one of those people who has been vehemently for unbanning Kokusho. Like, I think that card does not deserve to be on the ban list whatsoever anymore now.
I think the term crusade would be appropriate at this point for what you've been doing for it. I think I've slap on it.
Maybe jihad.
Perhaps, if we want to, you know, dip our toes in the politically incorrect end. Yes, I would say so.
Long story short, I've made a lot of pleads to the Rules Committee. I've made multiple threads on multiple forums and sites, like just pleading to them to just please unban Kokusho, because, and I've given them all this evidence and reasoning for why it should be unbanned, and like almost 2 years later, it's still banned despite all my efforts.
Before we get any farther into this, let's just read out what it does in case someone out there actually doesn't know, which is possible because it is banned, so a lot of people have never played with it.
All right. So just in case you've never heard of what Kokusho the Evening Star does, it's a black 6-mana creature, costs 4 colorless and 2 black. It's a 5/5 flyer dragon. It's a dragon spirit. It's legendary. And it says, when Kokusho the Evening Star goes to the graveyard from the battlefield, or when Kokusho dies, each opponent loses 5 life, and then you gain life equal to the total amount of life that was lost by all your opponents this way. So basically, it drains the table, and you gain a boatload of life. So basically, my big problem with Kokusho is that the card has basically become outdated in the sense that graveyard hate has gotten better, and there have been other creatures that have taken over its whole crux of the argument that used to be for why Kokusho was banned, in that it over-centralized games. The two cards, obviously, that immediately come to mind to me that over-centralized games that also cause the same as Kokusho are Primeval Titan and Consecrate Sphinx, especially since they actually generate card advantage instead of just gaining life. I know people have gotten pretty sick of Primeval Titan and or Consecrate Sphinx, and it's just one of those things where it's like, why is Kokusho banned when Primeval Titan and Consecrate Sphinx are free to rampage about? And I'm not trying to say that Primeval Titan or Consecrate Sphinx should be banned. Kokusho is just one of those cards that is like almost a relic of the ban list like 3 years ago when it got banned in 2008. Because keep in mind, there was no Relic of Progenitus, there was no Bojukabog, not a lot of other good creatures back then, because this was before the recent surge in the power creep of creatures. So that's my big problem with Kokusho, is that it's outdated. It just does not deserve to be banned.
I can sort of see that, and I do think that Kokusho should be unbanned at least for a little bit, like they did with Raphelos. It's worth noting that Kokusho and Recurring Nightmare were both banned at the same time. They've never existed without each other.
Yes.
And Recurring Nightmare obviously makes Kokusho just stupid, because you can keep switching between Kokusho and some utility guy and just keep draining the table and getting card advantage, and if people are playing with Recurring Nightmare correctly, you can never get rid of it without discard or counter magic. And so I think a lot of the reason that it's still banned is because people have bad memories of Recurring Nightmare that happen to involve Kokusho. but I can kind of see the argument for leaving Kokosho banned after playing with Donovan's Pauper Child of Alara deck. I don't know how you guys feel about having Kokosho legal as a general, or if you just want it unbanned for normal play, but it's still banned as the general. But that deck is capable of playing its general an awful lot and just letting it die, and then even if he gets removed from the game, you get to put it in your command zone and play it again. And we're going to talk about this later in this cast, but like, life gain is a lot better than people give it credit for, especially when you're gaining like between 10 and 20 points at a time. It is very, very good. I don't think that Kokosho is overpowered relative to the other absurd creatures like Primeval Titan and Consecrated Sphinx, but I can definitely see how it could take playgroups that are unprepared for it totally by surprise and just ruin games.
Well, my whole position on this is going to be that I'm going to be kind of playing devil's advocate, because I played with Kokosho extensively while it was still legal back in, I suppose it's considered back in the day now, and I hated that card. And then when Byron first brought up the idea of unbanning, I was really against it because of my experiences with it. But then I thought, you know what? Let's see how this goes. And I actually started playing with it. I've been playing with it for, I guess, around 8 months now. And it hasn't really been that bad. So I can honestly say I'm all for removing this card from the ban list. But for the sake of argument here, one of the first things I'm going to say is that the Rules Committee has explicitly said several times that it was banned because of like the concept of first-order strategies. And if you're not familiar with these, this is something that applies to a lot of competitive games, where there's multiple paths to victory, and players get to select how they're going to approach those. A good example is in fighting games. A first-order strategy is something that becomes discovered really early on in the game before much of the depth has been explored, and it appears as though it's overwhelmingly strong, but that's only because people haven't really plumbed the depths of what they're capable of doing within the context of the game's rules. And Kokoshu and Recursion is a first-order strategy of the highest magnitude, pretty much, in Commander. Like, this is something that appears to create a back-breaking advantage, and it does it over and over again in multiplayer games, especially in more casually oriented groups, and I think that's a lot of the reason that it's banned, is because it's just very unappealing to expose new players to that. So I think that's the majority of the reason that it remains banned. I don't necessarily think that's consistent, because any ban was with Kokoshu on it, but not with Survival of the Fittest. That's like a fundamental crack in the logic there that I can't really reconcile. But I can understand why that card is banned, if they're going for this whole first-order strategy concept.
Yeah, it's kind of nice they actually brought up the whole first-order strategy concept, Andy. But one of the things to keep in mind, though, is that like first-order strategies, Kokosho was a first-order strategy back in its day. Like now, a lot of first-order strategies, like you can take like a random like creature, for example, and then just
I think
like,
ramp decks now are the go-to first-order.
Yeah, like ramp decks are now like the first-order a really good first-order strategy now, because mass land destruction is still highly discouraged in a lot of playgroups. So it's like it's one of those things where the Rules Committee like actually has said that the reason they banned Kokosho is because it presents more of a problem in casual games than like more competitive ones. But at the same time, I think that logic is flawed, because there are many cards that just ruin casual games outright that aren't banned as well. Even though Kokosho is one of those cards where it kind of like sucks you in and thinks it's like a cool card, and then you realize it's unfun at the same time, there are a whole lot of cards that do that as well. Like, I think I would lump Primeval Titan, Consecrated Sphinx in that same group, because they are those cards that where you go like, wow, this card is really powerful. And then it's like, five games later, you're like, okay, we've seen enough of this card, let's move on, kind of thing. So I can kind of see like one argument there for like why Kokosho is still banned, but I wouldn't see why it couldn't just get a test run for like a couple months at least. Like, if you want to keep it banned as a general, that's fine, but why not just start out with unbanning Kokosho as a singleton and see where we can go from there?
Yeah, I just wanted to chime in and say that I agree with everything that's been said so far, especially with regards to the first order strategy bit, because when my playgroup was first starting out in EDH, we tried unbanning it for a while because we're like, it doesn't look like it's that big of a problem. And then we banned it again in a hurry. But this was 2 years ago. Our decks were, I'm not going to lie, I mean, they were pretty bad compared to what they are now. So I guess that lines up with what you were saying, Byron, about it maybe being more of a problem in casual games than it is
right
with in competitive or more tuned or experienced deck lists. But I mean, I agree with you on your point that is not necessarily a valid argument either. At this point, I'm pretty sure most of my decks would not care about Kokosho at all. That's pretty much where I stand. So I really don't think it's that much of a problem anymore.
Well, I think that's fair. Another thing is that if we were going to be banning cards on the criterion that they ruin casual games, I would more think that we would approach the kind of immediate offenders, like the more obvious ones, like Stasis. Because no one likes Stasis. Like, no one likes Stasis. No one likes having that played against them.
Yo!
Right? It's incredible. Well, I use it.
Unless you're a masochist.
Yeah, like, I use masochist. It. But when other people use it, yo, that's ridiculous. Like, get off me.
World Purge is unbanned, right?
Yeah, I think that's another good example of a card that's not going to be especially pleasant in casual games. But do you think that the distinction there is that those are cards that casual players are less likely to gravitate to? And if so, I suppose it's almost more of an issue of is that a legitimate way to place cards on the ban list?
Well, the reasoning that the Rules Committee gives is that, like for example, the World Purge, it's one of those cards that, like, a casual player supposedly wouldn't immediately gravitate towards because it's just, like, this big spell that just restarts the game, basically. Whereas, like, they might gravitate towards a card like Kokusho because it has this cool effect, and then they start playing with Kokusho, and then they realize, oh, this card is really good, and then they start, like, warping their deck around it. And then the games eventually devolve around, like, who controls Kokusho more and who gets more triggers than everyone else. And that's kind of where we were getting at the context of it ruins casual games. That's the reason that they gave. At the same time, I asked Sheldon and the rest of the Rules Committee, like, why isn't a card like Primeval Titan or Consecrated Sphinx banned? And they said the reason a card like Primeval Titan isn't banned is because Primeval Titan advances the game for everyone. Like, if everyone gets a piece of the Primeval Titan pie, everyone gets to mana ramp. But I don't think that's valid in the sense that there are, like, he says that, he also said at the same time that Kokusho, like, drags the game state down. It does nothing but cause, like, negative effects for everyone except you. But at the same time, like, why isn't Sundering Titan banned for the same reason? Because Sundering Titan forces you to destroy a maximum number of lands every time it enters and leaves the battlefield, for example. So, like, why isn't Sundering Titan banned? Kokusho is banned because it's causing a resource change that is not exactly tangible because it's not exactly generating card advantage like Sundering Titan, Primeval Titan, or Consecrated Sphinxes. So that was the other part of the argument for why Kokusho was banned, and it's also an argument that I'm not exactly thrilled with.
I have to say that I feel like all these arguments were valid at one point. Like, my playgroup has played quite a few games with Kokusho unbanned, and most of us don't even think we would include it in our decks. And even if we did, it's not terribly hard to deal with, and it's not going to be the first thing that we reanimate or clone or whatever. We're going to go after the Primeval Titans and the Sundering Titans and things like that. And I don't think the argument about warping a deck is very valid either, because if you're building your deck around a singleton, there are so many ways to deal with that in
And there are better cards modern. You can build around too.
Right, like, the first two cards in almost every white deck are, like, Swords to Plowshares and Path to Exile, and those handle Kokusho pretty well. There's, like, infinite graveyard hate and all kinds of other things that just deal with the problem. And so if someone's going to warp their deck around Kokusho, it's not very hard to just neuter their deck because you know what they're doing.
Okay, the last thing I kind of want to touch on builds up what Carlos was mentioning there, in the idea that, you know, if Kokosho's warping decks and stuff like that, but as playgroups go on, they discover it's less of a problem. So do you guys think that maybe that's another part of the reason Kokosho is banned? Because I can see this argument in that once Kokosho is introduced into an environment, it almost automatically triggers an arms race. Like, not only players will probably get better at Magic by playing in an environment that includes that card, but it also, I think, does hurt the kind of casual nature of the format. Like, superior play and casual, and then they kind of go downhill when the two meet in the middle, I find, a lot of the time. And I think that's a real concern you could have with that. But on the other hand, I don't think the ban list is really representing a casual format at this point anyway, so...
I mean, the arms race thing might be an issue, but I don't see Kokusho being, like, the cause of it. It's going to happen with any playgroup that's just starting out. Especially if it's like a format they've never played before. Kokusho might accelerate that to some bit, but I mean, the playgroup, if it wants to stay casual, can actively express their distaste for this card. And naturally, after arms races go so far, they usually stop and people say, whoa, what have we become? And they kind of backpedal a little bit anyway. Once you've played with everything that's out there, it's not so much a new thing anymore. So I don't see Kokusho like really being much of a problem in that regard either.
I have to agree. I think that the whole arms race phenomena is kind of exaggerated a little bit, because in most groups, or in most socially functional groups, it's pretty self-regulating. And the thing to me is that that Kokusho might have been a huge problem that was hard to deal with when it was a small format that only a couple of people played. But in this day and age, we have this thing called the internet. And there are all kinds of people who have posted these absurd combo Shroom lists and things like that. Kokusho is the thing that's least likely to trigger an arms race because there are all these absurd combos and stupid cards like World Gorger Dragon that are legal. And
Hermit
if
Druid.
Someone, right, like yeah, if someone Hermit wants Druid, to do something
survival,
degenerate, you're a lot more afraid of
the fittest.
You're yeah, a lot no. more afraid of like Hermit Druid and Survival of the Fittest and Sundering Titan than you are of Kokusho.
All right, so we're going to be summing up our Kokusho roundtable here, and basically we're all in agreement that Kokusho deserves to be unbanned completely. And he's basically, quote-unquote, like, outdated for both, like, the time he's been on the ban list and the arguments that have been given for why he needs to stay banned.
Okay, so, as always, we're going to conclude this with a single word from each participant. And we'll kick things off with Byron, since this is your jam.
I guess, outdated.
Okay. Donovan?
Inconsistent.
I'm going to say fun, because I've been playing with it, and I actually think it's pretty fun, and no one's had that much trouble with it. Carlos?
I think it's fun.
Biting my style.
Copycat. So,
I know. Well, you get him, D-Money. So that rounds out our free-for-all roundtable for this week. That was the Kokusho case. If you have your own thoughts, as always, get a hold of us via email. Get a hold of us on Twitter. The show information is always in the show notes. And that's it for the free-for-all. Next, we're going to go into talking about what we think are the best slash worst things about Commander. Next subject we're going to be talking about in community is the best slash worst things about Commander. This is something I hadn't really thought to talk about on the show for the longest time, but then I received a couple of emails, it was actually a little while ago, and I'm sorry I can't remember who exactly sent them in, that's mentioned a few times that, you know, a lot of the times we gripe, because we are Magic players, about certain things about the format. What do we think are the really good things? And some people have also asked, too, what are the things you dislike about the format as a whole? And I think this is an appropriate venue to share our thoughts as far as this goes. So what we're going to talk about are the things we like, the things that we don't, maybe some things we would like to change, why we're into this format in the first place, and what we think makes it unique and worth playing as opposed to other games and or formats. Now, in the past, I think I've been fairly clear that Magic isn't even like one of my favorite games. I'm someone that plays a lot of different games. I enjoy games in general. Magic is a pretty good game, but it has some things that really irk me that aren't even necessarily related to Commander. Like, any collectible game, in my opinion, is as a general rule, going to be pretty poor quality. Magic is the exception, and that's basically because it's like crack. I got addicted to it early on, and I just can't stop. Like, I know I could do heroin, and it's probably higher quality, but I'm just going to stick with this crack because I really want it right now. And that's the whole deal with Magic as a whole, as far as I go. I like playing Magic. It's an okay game, but it's not a great game as far as I'm concerned. And as far as Commander goes specifically, though, it's kind of alleviated a lot of those issues, or at least it did initially when I first started playing it. Like, to me, the main reason I play it, the main thing I like about it, is the fact that other people are playing it and it's not sanctioned. I have no interest in playing any sanctioned format anymore. I've completely lost any interest in competitive Magic that I ever had, and I did used to harbor that. I used to be a very invested Legacy player. I used to really like playing that. I used to go to tournaments all the time, and I used to draft like 3 times a week. And that kind of came to a crashing halt when I went to college. And then I discovered this, which was a little more along the lines I was interested in as far as a collectible card game went, because it was socially oriented. It was a great way to meet new players and kind of just hang out and sling cards. And the fact that it wasn't sanctioned meant that it attracted a different crowd, not only in terms of cards that were popular and expensive, which is another point, but also just in terms of the mentality of the people that were playing. And that was something that I think that's the major draw for me and is the main reason I continue to play it.
So I'm going to say, like, straight out, that I think the one thing that I like about Commander is also the one thing I hate about it, and that's that the format is so wide open. This is what makes Commander good, but it also makes it bad at the same time. Like, you can do anything you want, but at the same time, it's a bad format because you can do whatever you want, basically. I mean, Commander is basically like playing X-Men versus Street Fighter, and if you don't know what X-Men versus Street Fighter is, it's probably one of the most broken fighting games ever created, because the game engine in there is basically made out of paper, if that. And, like, everyone has brain-dead infinites. It's just broken beyond belief, because you can do anything in that game you want. There are no rules, basically. And that's basically what Commander is. There are basically no rules because the ban list is so small. You can abuse all the degenerate engines you want in the world. You can abuse Tier 1 tutors. You can abuse fast mana. You can play with bad cards like Squire. You can play with broken cards like Vampiric Tutor and Demonic Tutor and Survival Fittest and Soul Ring and Mana Crypt and all that stuff. And it's this nature that you can do whatever you want is what makes Commander probably the best thing about it, but it's also the format's big weakness, in my opinion, is that you can do whatever you want.
All right, now I'm going to take the super obvious route on this one and say that the best thing about Commander is definitely the social aspect of the format. Because to me, Magic is like two things. Number one, it's a means of social interaction. And number two, it's a creative outlet. And Commander just feels both of those in spades. Like all the cool stories that you know you remember and then you have laughs over and share later. Like those are all Commander games, at least in my experience, relative to other formats. There's a, like Byron said, there's the most stuff that can happen. So you just get blindsided by all these cards you never expected, and that's awesome. I love losing the cards that I've never read before.
I'm going to have to agree with Donovan and Byron. I like that the format is wide open. I like that people can play whatever they want and that everyone's going to be sitting down with a deck that they enjoy playing. Like, you can sit down and play competitive Magic one-on-one with whatever decks are popular, and some people just hate playing because they're playing this deck that they can't stand. And in Commander, you can play whatever your favorite cards or favorite deck that you've ever played are. And it's completely reasonable. You can play whatever terrible cards that you want just because you like the art on them or whatever, and it's fine. And so it's a lot more casual. People are a lot more laid back, a lot more relaxed. And I don't know, in general, as long as people aren't taking it too seriously, it's fun to play the game just for the sake of playing the game instead of for trying to break the metagame or whatever.
See, I will say as far as the notion of the open format goes, I think that kind of segues into one of the cons that I have with the format too, is that there are very mixed signals in terms of what it's about, both in terms of the way it's actually presented to people in general, as well as the way that different people play it. Like the signal is, okay, Sol Ring and Mana Crypt are not banned. What kind of format is this? Is this the format of Insurrection or is this the format of Storm Combo? You know, and I think that it's entirely legitimate to consider that confusing. Like, I don't see how you can almost not consider it that way, especially if you haven't played it before in a group that's been acclimatized to the sort of culture that Commander is associated with. And that's the other thing. I think the whole, that quote almost, culture that Commander is associated with, is almost completely empty at this point, because it's not really associated specifically with any one style of play anymore. Like, as it's been increasingly spread to other players, and I would say co-opted by the majority of the Magic community as well, like, once a site like Star City Games or Channel Fireball is posting about Commander, like, this is not a niche casual format really anymore. This is something that's become relatively widespread and will be examined by large numbers of players, or the hive mind as it's commonly referred to. And once you get to that point, you enter this realm of deck tuning and naturally competitive play, like Neil talked about when he was on the podcast from Wrong Way Go Back and Quiet Speculation. He talked about how he thinks that basically any format, once you're exposed to enough people, will gradually evolve to be more competitive, because that's just a natural tendency that people have. Online play, I think, does the same thing as well, both through being anonymous to the other players, so you don't have to be concerned with a social contract, and the general nature of online play, it just seems more cutthroat as a general rule to me. So I think that the mixed signals is one of the things that I really don't like about Commander, in that increasingly I've found that it's a format with an enormous identity crisis, and it's one that no one really wants to address.
Could you care to elaborate on that?
Sure. Like I've said before, to be honest with you, I don't really care what Commander ends up envisioned as. Some people have said that, you know, if it goes this way and that way, it will peter out. You know what?
So you're saying you just want it envisioned as, like, something specific so everyone understands what it is, instead of just everyone getting a different aspect of what Commander should be?
No, that being that way doesn't really bother me. I just find that it is confusing to a lot of people, and I think that is what generates a lot of the animosity you see between different groups of players. Like, there's always this whole casual and competitive divide that you see. And there's the group of people that want more regulation and less regulation. There's people that want more central control of the format and more decentralized control of the format. And at this point, it's really hard to say what is the identity of Commander? What's the core of the format?
Right off the top of my head,
see, it shouldn't take that long to answer that. I can tell you what Rainbow Stairwells is like that, or Stack like that. Right? And the other thing is, when we think about what we consider the core of Commander's identity, we actually have to pause and consider, well, wait, what are other people going to think of what we say? Whereas I think Stack or Big Box or
Type 4.
Yeah, or most draft formats in general, you know what it's going to be about. Cube, depending on the cube, whatever. But even then, with the enormous disparity between cubes, even Pauper cubes, you still know what cube is about when you sit down to do it. Commander, I think that might be the only format where that's not true.
I mean, the thing is that with other formats, the goal and the rules are built into the rules of the format instead of this whole idea of a social contract, which I don't really think is valid anymore. Like, I think I agree with you, Andy. One of the things that bothers me the most is that a lot of people, including the rules committee, continue on insisting on treating this like a grassroots format, which it's not anymore.
It is utterly and completely co-opted.
On Star City Games and Channel Fireball and whatever, it's not a grassroots format anymore. It's mainstream. And you can't say that local groups are going to handle the banned list on their own because people are playing with people like, I'm going to go to Grand Prix and play EDH. I'm going to go to Pro Tours and play EDH or whatever. And we all have to be able to play with these same rules. And so there's two crowds of people, one of which wants to play a quote-unquote casual game, and so they have like house bans, things like Obliterate and whatever, and you're going to get hated off the table if you play one. And then on the opposite end of the spectrum, they're the people who are saying, well, these cards are legal, so I must be allowed to use them however I want. The cards to play Storm Combo are legal, so it must be fine. And so I feel like the schizophrenic nature of the banned list is one of the worst things about the format, where cards like Protean Hulk are banned, and World Gorger Dragon is legal when they both lead to degenerate combos. What makes one better or worse than the other?
The fact that Protean Hulk is a one-card kill. That's the main reason.
I mean, World Gorger Dragon is a one-card kill with Riku. Like,
I'm not necessarily agreeing with the...
Right, I mean, the specific example doesn't matter. It's that the Rules Committee doesn't want to decide because they still insist that local playgroups can decide. And this has gotten much bigger than local playgroups.
Well, I don't know if that's so much a function of the Rules Committee not wanting to decide so much as other people not wanting to agree with what the Rules Committee has said they want the format to be. Like, I think it's fairly clear that...
What do they want the format to be?
Well, Alex...
Can you tell?
Yeah, Alex was on the show, and he said it out loud, and I think Sheldon's pretty vocal about it every time that he shows up just about anywhere. And the same with Papa Funk. Like, they're fairly clear that they want it to be a casual multiplayer format with a social contract forming the core of it. But I think that's been subverted, and I don't mean that to have a negative connotation. I know that's a word with a lot of baggage, but I think that that's been, I suppose circumvented is more appropriate. Circumvented by such a large group of players, yeah, who are accustomed to playing Magic in a different way, and now they're looking at this format in a different way, and there's nothing necessarily right or wrong with that. That's just the way that things are, and as a result, things will change with this influx of new players.
In that respect, I think that probably one of the things that makes Commander so much fun, the social contract thing, I agree that it's probably one of its biggest downfalls too. And that other formats of Magic, they impose these sets of rules that all pretty much make sense inside the game. Like, here are some deck building restrictions. Here's, you know, your starting life total. And Commander has those too, but then it also tries to impose a set of rules that are outside of the game too.
Like, the fundamental the fundamental tenets of the game are mechanically enforced, as opposed to just people making an agreement on something.
Exactly. And now at this point, you're relying on individuals' personalities for the stability of the format. And that can work. That can work. But, I mean, obviously, you know, it causes a lot of friction, too.
See, to me, what you just mentioned, the idea that the format is actually built basically on individuals, I think that's a very good idea. And I think that's produced a very strong format. But I don't think that it's necessarily good for everybody. Like, to me, that's very appealing, but the notion that competitive Magic will collapse overnight is also appealing to me because the card prices will go down, right? Like, so I'm kind of looking at this from a different perspective. Like, I'm not that invested in it. Like, I have a shelf behind me full of dead games that are no longer in production, but I continue to play them. Whereas for a lot of other people, like, a lot of the interest will fade if something happens. Like with 5-color, I still play 5-color and I enjoy it. But once kind of the central regulation fell apart, it fell out of vogue, there were no more prizes available for it, we can all kind of see where that went. And there were a myriad of reasons for that format collapsing in general, right? But,
right.
Like, my perspective isn't, I don't think it's the best one to gauge what is going to be healthy for everyone as a whole. Like, I also really like deregulation. Like, I would prefer that local play groups were capable of sorting out their differences, because I think that promotes being a social game. And even if you are to travel abroad and play with other people, I think if you want to play a social format, the notion that you have to socialize with other people over what cards you think are acceptable are a positive and not a negative. They're not actual game state related things or rules related things. That's the peripheral culture of the format, which I would like to see promoted. But like I said, I don't think my perspective is probably the one that's very universal.
I kind of have to agree with you guys. Like, when you have a social group that's capable of, like, working out their differences in a constructive and positive way and, like, play games and enjoy them because you're interacting and you're being social, it's awesome. And so I have to ask what you guys think of these, like, these phrases that just get thrown around to justify being antisocial, like the he's bad at threat assessment, you're violating the spirit of the format, you're an EDH douchebag or whatever. How do you feel about, like, how prevalent these phrases have become and how people just kind of throw them around to justify being a jerk?
Online or in the real?
Both. All the time. Everywhere. It's getting really frustrating around my table, at least.
It really is. And I find them, like, coming out of my own mouth every once in a while, usually in, like, a sarcastic manner, but not all the time. That kind of frightens me because, I mean, for this to be such a social format, that's one of, like, the most unsocial things you can do is just go out and call people names to prove your point.
I think part of that comes down to, especially online, obviously, you know, everyone is super tough on the internet, right? And that's just something you have to consider. But in the real, I haven't seen too much shit talk, especially of the nature that you're describing, Carlos. Like, there's ribbing, but you should just expect that depending on what your social environment is like. But generally speaking, I find that a lot of the time when people use those baggage-loaded terms like EDH douchebag, which I have written about how horrible that is for everybody, in a way, if you get called that, a lot of the time I think that is, you know, there are times where it's just literally crazy. Like, before that, we were talking about Carlos. He cast a capsize with buyback, and people lost their shit. And, like,
yeah, they were blocking him on MTGO.
Yeah, like that. See, that's crazy talk. And there are crazies everywhere. That's not a magic thing. That's just a life thing. But a lot of the time, if you're called something like that, like, I'm not going to lie, I played some land destruction the other day. I destroyed a whole table's lands, and people were not pleased with the outcome of that game. And to me, that wasn't like, oh, well, these guys need to get on my level, or, oh, I'm not an EDH douchebag. These guys are just scrubs. You know, and those are all a lot of terms that are loaded with connotations to the Commander community. To me, being called that was actually like a call for introspection. Like, wait, should I be playing like that with these guys? Like, am I being a dick? Like, it's an important thing is they're not using the appropriate term there, obviously. It's never really appropriate to call someone a douchebag. But when it's just the culture that you're part of, and whether we like it or not, it is part of the format's culture, I think that we have to look at both sides of that issue. Like, it's not just jackasses calling other people being sore losers and stuff like that. It's also, you know, they're expressing their frustrations. They're not being terribly social about it.
Going back to your original question, Carlos, I think the reason that you see it, like, people getting mad and throwing out that kind of stuff is because, like, people get lost in the heat of the moment. And instead of trying to, like, you know, think calmly, like, why exactly they lost in a specific context, they want to immediately, like, go, you know, like, throw out some sort of name or something like that, or, you know, get angry of some sort. And it's just one of those things where it's like, you know, even though you're playing a format that's supposed to be casual by nature, I mean, people still get caught up in wanting to win the game because, like, it's just one of those things where it's like, even though you want to play casually, you still want to at least, like, you know, try to, like, you know, do something at least, like, if you don't want to win the game outright. People just get mad and they just lose it in the heat of the moment. It's one of those things where it's like, if you just take a deep breath and, you know, step back to think about, like, why something happened, you could probably go back calmly and say, like, well, here's what you probably should have done instead of, like, taking me out of the game when it just helped the guy that was already ahead in the long run, for example. So I think that's part of the reason why you see that, like, especially online when there's really no recourse, but, like, even in real life as well when you have the context of physical interaction.
You know what you guys are saying, like, that I couldn't agree with you more. We've talked about what we think the best thing about the format is, what the worst thing about the format is. I think the best thing for the format would be if players could have maybe a good sense of sober self-assessment. Like Byron said, you know, everyone's temper flares every once in a while, but if you could just take a breath, step back, realize, hey, you know, we're playing a card game, this is supposed to be fun, then I really think that that is where the most fun in Commander is had.
Yeah, I have to agree, and I'm glad that you guys could give some perspective on that. The best thing about the format is when everyone can, like, take a step back and they know what they're doing and they're treating everyone reasonably well. And to me, the worst thing is that when we create this, a lot of formats have, like, a monetary entry barrier, and this one seems to have a social entry barrier that there are at least a lot of people around here who don't want to start playing because they don't feel like dealing with all of that. And so I feel like the worst thing about the format is when we let that get in the way of letting people get involved.
Well, it's actually kind of interesting you mentioned a social barrier entry, because to an extent I disagree, and I think it's actually a good thing. And I don't mean in terms of like, oh man, check out this guy that I've never played with. What a dick. We're not playing with him. I more like the fact that this format doesn't really work unless you can socialize with other people. Because I've played Tournament Magic, and my interest in playing with socially retarded legacy burnouts has gone well below zero at this phase. So I don't really want to play games with other people that don't have an interest in meeting that barrier to entry that means you have to be able to talk to another human being socially and have a good time and laugh about what's happening at the table. I think that's awesome. Maybe you consider that elitist, but when it comes to my free time, I don't want to get bagged on by someone because I played a bad card in their eyes.
No, I think we actually agree. What I'm talking about is people who have that attitude who are already playing.
Oh, casual and
driving people who would be social and reasonable and whatever away from the format.
Okay, that's real.
Because they don't feel like dealing with these people who are elitist and whatever.
Okay.
It's almost like they're taking the social contract and twisting it to their own perspective, essentially.
The casual inquisition, as we've called them many times.
Yeah.
It would fall into that banner.
An elegant way of putting it.
So to move along from kind of the social element of things, there are some other things I want to talk about as far as good and bad things about Commander. One thing, and this is super basic, is that you only need one of each card. Like, I get so tired of chasing down four ofs for my casual, like, 60 and fours. And it's just beautiful to actually open up a booster pack and be like, oh, a card. Well, I've got a home for you, you know? Like, I don't have to go and look for these one-ofs anymore. I have one-ofs to look for now as opposed to, like, three-ofs or four-ofs. And that's just kind of a nice feeling to be able to open up a booster pack and just think immediately, this can go in a deck.
Yeah, that's probably one of my favorite things, too. The fact that the one-of restriction, like, opens up so much room in your deck, like, relative to 60-card formats. And we all know that room runs out quicker than you'd want it to.
Mm-hmm.
But still, looking back, when I go try to build a 60-card deck, like, it's so boring in the sense that, oh, well, this is a
the space is already
tide.
Gone.
Yeah, it's like, this is a high-tide deck. This is a so-and-so deck. And it's like, that's what it does. That's what it's going to do every single game. But then, in Commander, you know, you've got 100 different cards most of the time. And you can just fit so much crap into one deck that, like, it's kind of bad, but it's a lot more fun. Like, now it's a Survival of the Fittest deck, plus it's a token deck, plus it's a Revelark deck, plus mm-hmm. it's whatever the heck I had laying around. I dig that.
I'm actually going to play a little devil's advocate here, and I'm actually going to say that, in some instances, the Highlander nature of Commander is kind of problematic. And the reason I say this is because, in a fundamental nature, Dave Price once said, there are never wrong threats, but there are wrong answers. And Commander is one of those formats, because you have access to literally almost anything you can play, there are a lot of explosive plays going around, and there are like a lot of like very volatile like cards going around as well. And sometimes, and a lot of times, I should say, these cards need to be answered immediately. And although 60 card, you know, four of like constructed decks do kind of limit your creativity in the sense that like not like commander doesn't, you can at least like be able to hope to, you know, have a good chance of drawing the answer you need. Whereas in Commander, you can only run like one of a certain card, and then you have to run like a different type of answer if you want to have more reactive cards. So it can be frustrating, like for example, if you want spot removal, but at the same time you still want to have some sweepers to be able to take care of someone else that's spitting out a lot of tokens, but you still want to have your spot removal for like a general like Xur, for example, that you need to kill before you can get your bulky sweepers online. It can be one of those things that can be really annoying at times, and I'm just saying this from a deck builder point of view and also like from like just a kind of a competitive player of view. Sometimes like answers can really be a bit of a problem when you are restricted to one of a card, for example. Like, imagine playing Vintage where Force of Will was restricted. That's just an example.
Yeah, so, I mean, there's definitely a lot greater variance in the format. But I'm starting to see a common trend here where the format's greatest strengths are all some of its biggest setbacks.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was kind of more devil's advocate there, slightly, but it's just one of the annoyances I have sometimes with the Highlander nature. Plus, I don't get to play cards like Line of War Sentinel and then just play like 50 billion of them.
You can only play one Terramorphic Expanse.
That's the
worst. You
can
only play one Squadron Hawk.
I know, come on.
Oh, man, yeah, I definitely have not seen enough of that in the last couple months.
Yeah, imagine if you could play like 50 Squadron Hawks and just keep chaining them together.
God, that would be
Sounds like Relentless Rats, but kind of worse.
Yeah, but you get to play Skullclamp to draw more Squadron Hawks.
Oh, yeah, because you need to draw more Squadron Hawks.
Yeah. I almost ran out of Squadron Hawks, but then I played another Squadron Hawk, and I was okay.
Disaster averted.
I really like the singleton nature of the format because it forces you to think outside the box. You can't just say, like, oh, I need spot removal. Let me jam four Swords to Plowshares. You have to, like, go find other things that either fill similar roles or find a more roundabout way to do it. And this leads to some, like, crazy cards that you've never seen before getting played that are obviously not the best, but in their, like, corner case, they're just absurd. I can't even remember the name of this card, but someone played, it was, like, one in a white sorcery, remove all creatures and all graveyards from the game and gain a life for each of them.
That just wrecked
an entire table. Like, what is this card? Where is it? I've never seen it before, and it just won them the game on the spot because everyone was playing graveyard decks and they removed all of the key components. Like,
tasty.
Any format where random cards like that can just win a game because people weren't expecting them, and that's the particular scenario where it's good, that's awesome to me because these are cards that aren't getting played anywhere else.
All right, my final point in this discussion, and I don't know if this is necessarily a pro or a con, this is kind of something I think falls in between, is that Commander as a whole, I think people have kind of become confused between what makes the format appeal to them and why they play games with certain people. Like, I think when people can attribute, like, oh, man, we were having this crazy game and everyone was high-fiving each other and having a great time and blah, 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 I don't think that's something that's necessarily to be attributed to Commander as a format. I think that's more something that you've managed to accomplish by playing with people that are awesome. It could be any game. Like, I think that as a whole, Commander, we've talked about, is a super wide open format where a lot of things can happen. And a lot of those things aren't very interesting or fun. Like, there's Temple Bell and Mind Over Matter, which is really strong. Survival-based decks, super fast Voltron decks with Xur and stuff like that. Lots of prison decks, repeated sweepers. Like, a lot of those things aren't particularly interesting. This is a format that's only as good as the people you're playing it with. So as a result, I think a lot of people have confused whether they really like playing Commander or whether they really like playing with the people they play Commander with. I don't think, like, especially, it depends on how kind of myopic your vision is towards games in general and Magic even in general, because there are many variants of Magic a lot of people haven't explored. I think if you take a moment and look at other games or other games of Magic that you can play, and if you play them with the same people, you would find maybe that there's one that even appeals to you more than Commander does. It's just that Commander kind of gave you a nudge towards playing with these people in that kind of social context. And now that you've broken that barrier, a lot of the time you can substitute almost any game in there and produce the same result.
Right. I think what makes it fun is the interaction with other people, the breaking of that social barrier, as it were. But I do think that Commander is one of the more one of the formats that's the most conducive to that sort of thing. Because, I mean, when's the last time you saw two friends get paired up, like, in a Legacy Top 8 and, like, high-fiving each other for the plays that they made? It's,
mm-hmm.
Like, it just doesn't happen very often in that sort of environment. Like, I guess just any casual multiplayer format is going to be more conducive to that sort of thing. And Commander just happens to be one of those.
Mm-hmm.
I think that combined with the fact that Commander is a thing where if you're playing a deck that you built, you're going to be doing something that you like doing, and everyone's going to be doing something that they like doing. It kind of helps, at least helps to avoid, like, the games where absolutely nothing is going your way, and you at least have, even if you're losing, you're playing a deck that you like, doing a thing that you like with people that you like. And so that's an upside that, to me, where that other formats just don't necessarily have.
at least I still have this Ruination.
Yeah, because that's the kind of card that everyone smiles when you play.
Oh, yeah. I really don't have much more to say about this. I mean, we've hit a lot of key components about, like, what makes Commander good and what makes Commander bad. Basically, it really boils down to a lot of the same stuff that we've been saying in a lot of, like, several different episodes in the past. Segueing into that, for the most part, Commander is just one of those things where it's like, I think Donovan put it well, that I think the format's best attributes about it are also its biggest problems with it. And I would totally agree with that statement right there.
Okay, so that's it for our community segment this week. This was a pretty big one. So if you guys have your own thoughts on this, and I'm sure that you do, get a hold of us. The contact information is always in the show notes. Next, we're just going to do one quick community spotlight for my man, Calvin. This week's community spotlight, I got a blog by my man, Calvin. Longtime Commander Cast fan. He's been a huge supporter for a long time. He was on the first call-in episode as well. Calvin has started his own blog called Three to the Face. You can find it in the show notes. There will be a link, obviously. And as well, it's been in the Friday Flashback for the last little while. But in case you need the URL audibly, because we all know that's the easiest way to get them, it's threetothefacebot.com. And his logo is totally sweet. It's the fairy from Flusterstorm getting hit by a lightning bolt imposed on it, hitting him in the face. So I'm all right with that. But yeah, Calvin's putting in some good work here. He started off like real small, real subtle. And lately, his articles are funny, which I appreciate, without sledgehammering you with the fact that they're funny over and over again, so they don't feel forced at all. Like, it's very natural. And what he tends to do is theme decks, Commander theme decks. So, for example, a little while ago, he did an unglued themed deck, which was, you know, it was actually pretty funny. As someone that finds those, I'm almost allergic to how unfunny those unglued cards are in general. Like, they're just not funny to me, but I enjoyed the article. And then he's starting a series for each guild. He's doing an article now, and he's got like the Thundercats theme deck on there, which was mono white. So yeah, I just want you guys to be aware of the fact that this site is there. We are affiliated with him. He's part of the Knowledge Pool Network. So I would go check him out. It's pretty solid stuff. And I just want to congratulate him as well on the fact that he is about to have a child. So good looking out to you, Calvin. And again, the URL is threetothefacebot.com.
Starting off this week's strategy segment, we're talking about another false idol, and this week it's going to be that life gain is bad. Life gain is typically something that more experienced players know to just, like, ignore, and that newer players think is awesome, and it's something that kind of distinguishes the more experienced players from the newer one, and we're going to talk a little bit about whether or not this is true in Commander, what kind of value that life gain has, if it does have any, and how you try to evaluate it within a game depending on whether or not you have like the alternate life gain win conditions and things like that. Personally, I think it can be very well positioned in a certain metagame because a lot of decks are designed to deal somewhere around 40 points of damage because that's how much life you have. And if you can gain more than that, then you can make it very difficult for them to be able to kill you, especially if you can gain large quantities of life at a time or prevent large quantities of damage. I've had a lot of success playing decks that just gain incremental amounts of life over the course of the game and make it difficult to kill them. But I'm interested in hearing what some of your impressions are and how you guys have kind of seen life gain over your experiences with the format.
Well, I think one of the main culprits for this rumor spreading so much is that like not only is life gain as a mechanic undesirable in a lot of cases, but also like a lot of life gain cards are just plain terrible. Last time I played a 2/2 that gained me 2 life for 3 mana, I'm pretty sure I lost that game. But there are some hidden gems, like Carlos said, you can just make up for it in the cards that gain you such a large quantity of life, like Martyr of Sands or Congregate, that sometimes it's just the death blow to decks that want to kill you through creature beats or other deal damage to you in other ways.
So actually, one of the things that is actually really nice about life, especially if you're gaining large quantities of it, is that I've noticed that in some games that life gain makes it so that it makes it undesirable for your opponents to attack you, and if they could always attack someone else. And I kind of want to refer to this as like the shark swing around you syndrome, or blood in the water syndrome, or whatever you want to call it. But it's one of those. Oh no.
Okay, let me elaborate. Son.
See the writing on the wall.
Let me elaborate on this. So basically, like, let's say you have like any freedom to attack anyone you want. It's very likely that if you want to like attack someone, you're probably going to attack someone who has the lowest amount of life. If no one's like anyone else is directly affecting you, because it's going to take less effort to take that person out. Like, if someone has, like, 80 life and someone has 20, it's very likely that you don't want to just waste resources and try to take out the guy with 80 life when you can deal with him later. I know, it's just, like, a lot of, like, at least in my mind, and I know in other people's minds, it's better to take out the person that has 20 life because you don't have to burn as many resources to do the job. And when you're gaining life, you're making it, like, more undesirable for you to attack to be attacked if... we're talking about just about like creatures in Burn, for example. So that's one of the cool things that life gain does, is that it bolsters your main resource enough to the point to where, like, if someone has been softened up by someone and they got hit, they got, you know, planked in by some creatures and got dinked around for a bit of damage, they're likely to be taken out just from the fact that people don't want to exert as much effort into killing your ridiculous life total compared to someone who's just about to drop from the game.
I think that something that needs to be considered also is whether or not people know you're playing Felidar Sovereign or Test of Endurance. Those two cards are something that really changes the dynamic of life gain, if depending on people what know you're running them or not, because then they know what they have to keep your life total under, otherwise you can just win. Something else that needs to be considered is that you have this resource, and you want to make sure that you keep it relevant, and so you have to be prepared for other alternate win conditions. Like, you need to be able to make sure that you can prevent general damage from just killing you, regardless of what your life total is, or that you can keep yourself from getting decked, or make sure you don't lose to Epic Struggle or something like that. You need to be prepared for those things, so you make sure that your high life total is still relevant.
I think life gain is definitely best when kind of used in an ambush context, like you're talking about there. If people are less aware of the fact that you are playing a deck that has a considerable amount of life gain in it, then its value goes up substantially. But another thing with life gain, I think even if you do have the capacity to gain a lot of life, don't necessarily just do it. Like, for me, where I found the value in life gain, and this is where I started reconsidering the paradigm that life gain is bad, is that if you use it to maintain yourself in the middle of the pack, that's where it's at its ideal. If you just use it to kind of look like you're treading water, but in reality, you have the capacity to send your life total substantially higher at any given time. You can kind of manipulate the flow of the game. That's the ideal position. It's like you want to look like the second most powerful, has been said a lot about multiplayer Magic. And this is true with your life total as well, because for all that people talk about how life card gain cards are bad and everything, people still tend to attack people with the highest life total if they haven't picked a target yet. And while I think that's generally, you know, something that is really bad, even coming from me... Like, if I know that that's bad, come on, guys. Everyone should know that that's bad. You should never pick who you're attacking based on, like, oh, he's got two more life than everyone else. Fucking terrible. But use your life total to suspend yourself in the middle of the pack. Don't go too far above and raise attention either. Because a lot of the time, if you're burning, like, a card I really like, I'll talk about later, is Feud Killer's Verdict, it gains 10 life. That's a lot of life, unless you're at 20 life. And then it just looks like you're doing nothing and you're getting a 5-5 for 6. Which is awesome, because it's a nice stealthy thing. You're getting a dude. That's a dude that's going to have some impact. You're keeping yourself out of the danger zone. That's where I find life gain has its best application.
Yeah, I definitely think that's the best use, because so many games of EDH I've played that have gone long, you know, you find you just get nickel and dime to death over the course of the game. And all those games that you've won, you know, it's like, oh, I was behind, but I just managed to, you know, draw that extra burn spell and just kind of reach for the win. If your opponent had any kind of life gain to throw him out of range, like, you couldn't have done that. So, I mean, life gain, it doesn't just stop you from losing, but it can actively help you win.
I think something else that's kind of overlooked for a lot of people who play the life gain decks is that you have to be very careful about who you're trying to kill and when you're trying to kill them. Like, there are a lot of decks that just can't deal more than 40 points of damage, like I was saying, And so you need to try to get the game to go in such a way that the people who can deal large amounts of damage, like the token decks with overruns and things like that, you want to try to make sure that they die before you start gaining absurd amounts of life. And then once they're gone, you can just sort of start going off and gaining infinite life or whatever. You just need to make sure that you deal with the people who can make your life total irrelevant, like I've been saying. You want to make sure that it's still a resource that you can take advantage of, as opposed to someone being able to just play Triumph of the Hordes or whatever and make all this work you've done meaningless.
Going to the whole, like, using life as a resource, like, life gain is especially relevant if you're running a lot of cards that, like, take a big bite of your life total. Like, cards like Phyrexian Arena and Necropotence, for example, they can really drain your life total. And that goes for a lot of, like, black cards in general. So, like, life gain is just a great way to, you know, replenish your life total and keep it at a nice medium to where you're not going to be that one person to where, like, when someone's trying to eliminate someone from the game just by, like, swinging with their army, they're not looking at you automatically because, like I said before, it takes the least amount of effort to kill someone with the lowest life total. So, like, if you're constantly, like, you know, hitting yourself and plinking yourself with a lot of life-draining stuff, like Bitter Blossom is another good example, Arena Effects in black, even, like, Dark Confidant, for example. Like, I've seen people rock Dark Confidant in Commander, and life gain is a great way to keep yourself replenished and make sure you're constantly getting the advantage that you're getting from the cards that are draining the life from you.
I think it's funny that you mentioned that, actually, Byron, because I see a lot of people talk about how, okay, well, paying, you know, 2 life to draw these 2 cards off my Hoarder's Greed or whatever, like, paying that life is so inconsequential when you have 40 life. And I don't know how much of that is just, like, kind of internet theory craft. To me, that's just not really, like, it's a great thing to say in a vacuum, but in reality, during real games of Commander, I very rarely find I actually have 40 life. Like, because I'm playing with other people that attack me sometimes, and therefore my life goes down. So those effects are really compounded, and I find a lot of times the guys that are really reckless with their Necropotence or something, they just get wrecked because of it, and I laugh all day every time it happens.
I have to agree. I've played a lot of life gain decks, and I've played a lot of decks that pay life to do things, and you can tell the people who have done that before and have played a lot of multiplayer because they don't spend a huge amount of life at once, because they know they have to live until their next turn. And you can't just, like, pay 39 life to draw cards off of Necropotence and assume that you'll live until your next turn, because there's 2 to 5 players who are going before you, and only one of them has to, you know, do a little bit of damage, and then you're just dead. And then those cards don't do you any good at all. Something that's interesting to think about is that, like, for most people, they would pay 1 or 2 life to draw a card. Typically, they would probably pay more if there were cards that did that, but most cards like Greed or Necropotence or Yawgmoth's Bargain want you to pay 1 or 2 life. It's interesting to think about how much life you want to gain out of a single card for it to be worth it, because usually you want to gain more than 1 or 2 life because a card is worth more than that. For most people, I think the number is somewhere around, like, between 6 and 8 you want to regularly gain off of a single card in order to make it worthwhile.
Do you mean, like, playing an actual life gain card? Or do you mean how much life you would value the card being worth?
How much life you would value the card as being worth. You want it to be at least, like, 6 to 8 life for it to be worthwhile. Usually more than that, because most of them are static effects.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'll definitely play something like Martyr's Cause, because I know it'll gain a ton of life over the course of a game by preventing general damage and things like that. Or I'll play a card like Sun's Bounty, because I know that even though every time I play it, it's worth 4 life, I can get it back multiple times, so it's going to represent, like, between 8 and 20 life over the course of a game.
I think another thing that's interesting to talk about, like you mentioned earlier with the paying life effects, and to expand on Byron's analogy of the blood in the water effect, is that paying a bunch of life for Necropotence is the least inconspicuous thing you can ever do. Like, oh, look, guys, I'm hurting myself to get resources I'm going to beat you with. Like, it's so obvious you can just wear a neon sign until your chest hair burns. I guess that's not applicable for the ladies, but whatevs. There's nothing you can do to really deter people from attacking you at that point. You're just making yourself so obvious in doing it. So either those cards have to give you one hell of a plan, or maybe you can experiment with being a little more conservative with those effects.
I think, on the other hand, there's cards like Well of Lost Dreams, and that card can fly under the radar for so many turns because you're not drawing a million cards at once unless you know, you're gaining too much life for your own good and becoming a target anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But when you gain, like, two or three life at a time and draw one or two cards at a time, people just don't tend to notice. It's like the guy who plays Rhystic Study and everyone gets really upset when he keeps nagging them to pay, but don't notice all the cards that he's drawing when they don't feel like paying.
And then when they notice, it's too late.
Or if you're playing a Life King deck, you can just say, I'm just going to use these to gain more life. That doesn't matter, right? This is terrible.
Now, another thing I want to mention here, too, is that in terms of metagame-specific advice, if you're playing in a less developed metagame, and I don't mean that to be derogatory, I more mean that your group has decided to play an increasingly casual game style. Like, there are infinite combos have a lesser presence, prison lock decks are less common, time warp decks are more or less unheard of. The axes that Life Game plays along will be the main one that the game determines the game, and at that point, it's just so much stronger. In developed metagames, I think that Life Gain is pretty much worthless. I will say that. In a couple of my groups where I'm going to be playing things like my Hanna Hardlock decks and stuff like that, Poison decks, if those are really common, fast Voltrons, then yeah, obviously you don't want to use Life Gain because what you're doing with it is literally meaningless. Like, I think it was discovered a while ago that in Commander, it's best to just bypass the life thing completely if you really want to win. But then how many people are really devoted to just winning games? I think that's where a lot of the value of life gain comes from. It's almost like ramp in that you're preying on people's expectations of how the games are going to go. And that sounds rather insidious, but that's just kind of how it is.
Yeah, I'll agree with that. But I do disagree pretty strongly that you say life gain like is pretty terrible in developed metagames. I mean, There are some decks, I guess a good chunk of decks, that just kind of ignore life totals. But there are a lot that don't. I mean, some decks, like, for example, Mono Black Control will ramp up to obscene amounts of mana and, like, exsanguinate for the win or just, like, pile up all these other damage effects like Wound Reflection or whatnot. Life Gain can be a good way to foil those plans. This is kind of a somewhat related example, like, there are some combo decks that just aim to do, like, a set amount of damage with their combo. Like, I can't think of... I guess Pandemonium with Sapperling Burst, you know, just to deal 21 damage. Or maybe someone's trying to Tendrils of Agony you out. But Life Gain can really throw off that math, too. So it's got some other merits, even in combo-based metagames.
I think one of the problems that Life Gain has and why it's considered bad is because, like, just life gain by itself causes card disadvantage. And card advantage is especially important in Commander because you're having to deal with multiple players and you have to partition out those resources to multiple players as well, unless you use politics to your advantage, but that's a different story for a different day. But long story short, like life gain just by itself generates no intrinsic tangible advantage. Like you're keeping yourself in the game longer, but you're not actually like generating more resources in the fact that you can actually use, for example. I mean, it's not a super tangible resource like mana or card drawing or, you know, like graveyard utilization, for example. So that's one of the problems that life gain has and why it's considered such, you know, terrible. Especially like, as we said before, you start out with 40 life. It's like giving everyone a gain 20 life spell at the start of the game. And it's like, you want to gain more life and people just undervalue things like life gain in the wrong context when it all comes down to it.
See, I have to disagree that life gain is intrinsic card disadvantage. It puts you into a lot of advantageous positions, even if it's not, like, drawing you cards. Like, a story circle doesn't destroy any creatures or draw you cards. But it can blank a number of cards on the battlefield, and it can put you in an advantageous position.
But Story Circle is a different card. I mean, it's not exactly life. It's not exactly pure life gain. It's mainly like a card. It's mainly like an attack deterrent, for example.
Right, but isn't life gain in general an attack deterrent? Like, if I have Martyr of Sands and Nim Deathmantle in play, and I can gain like 9 life per iteration, people aren't going to be very likely to attack me because I'm just going to gain the life back. And that's a kind of card advantage.
Yeah, but the stakes change if they're hitting you with your commander or if they're hitting you with an infect creature.
I'm going to agree with Carlos on this one. Like, I mean, in most cases, I'd say life gain is not the point of the deck. I guess there are some cards that make it the point, like Felidar Sovereign. But while most of the time I can see where you're coming from, Byron, that it is kind of an inherent card disadvantage. But a lot of times the life gain is not the engine you're trying to set up. It's like you've got your engine established in some other way. And life gain is what keeps you in the game and helps that engine keep going. So it's not the engine itself, it's the maintenance that limits your opponent's outs. So it is an answer, just like a counter spell is an answer. So all in all, I'm going to say that life gain is just underrated. It may not be for your deck or for your specific metagame, but you might want to take a second look at it.
So that's the end of the False Idols for this week. Life gain is bad. I'm sure there's lots of thoughts out there again on this. This is something that's kind of cropped up every now and then on forums. I've had some discussions about it in the real, so I think it's a little bit more contentious than a lot of people understand or are willing to admit, because I still see life gain in there every now and then. There's a lot of coincidental life gain effects that are really good, but we'll be talking about that in technology. And we're going to follow up on our life gain subject with some life gain tech.
This technology segment, we're going to be talking about first our favorite life gain cards that are really good. We're excluding lifelink creatures because they're typically pretty obvious. They're giant creatures that have lifelink, and so they're good because they're giant creatures and coincidentally have lifelink. One of my favorite life gain cards that I found extremely abusive is Martyr of Sands. It's a common from Cold Snap for a white. It's a 1/1, and you pay a white and sacrifice it, and reveal any number of white cards from your hands to gain 3 life per white card revealed. White is a color that's very good at recurring creatures with, like, Emyria or Proclamation of Rebirth or Nim Deathmantle, which you can tutor up with Stoneforge Mystic, and Martyr of Sands usually gains you between 9 and 15 life each time you sacrifice it, and that adds up very, very quickly. And so this is a card that can put games out of reach for a lot of decks pretty quickly. And I've been very, very happy with it, especially for being a one drop from a terrible set.
Well, terrible is a strong word there, but yeah, it was fucking terrible.
It was Cold Snap.
Yeah, it was pretty bad. Yeah, it's hard to disagree with that. This card's really frustrating to play against, so.
By far, it gives you the biggest bang for your buck if you want pure life gain. I mean, Martyr Sands has every pure life gain spell beat.
Yeah, it's pretty good like that. The other thing is, it's very good, especially like Carlos is talking about, with the capacity to bring it back to life repeatedly in white. It's something you can do very selectively as well. So you don't have to sledgehammer people with the fact that, oh my god, I'm at a billion life. Oh no, 21 general damage. You know, you can very easily use it to kind of float in that middle range like we were talking about in the strategy segment. It's very good as far as that goes.
Yeah, you don't have to reveal all the cards in your hand all the time.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll go next with my first pick, which is another white card, Feud Killer's Verdict. This is a rare, it's a tribal sorcery. It's a giant, like a giant spell from Morningtide. It was a rare. It costs 4 colorless and double white. You gain 10 life. Then if you have more life than an opponent, put a 5/5 giant warrior token onto the battlefield. So basically you get a giant guy for 6 mana. I have never cast this and not gotten the guy. Gaining 10 life is substantial. Like think about it, how much would you be willing to pay for a giant guy that has lifelink? Right, and then it's effectively like you've swung with him twice. I find that's pretty good value. The other thing that I really like about it is that it gives you a good guy that has a pertinent body, and he wears equipment that you're going to be playing, because, like, let's face it, white loves equipment. So there's a very good chance you're going to be looking for stuff for bodies to carry around your gear. And the life gain is just kind of a little sexy bonus there. Like, you just tack that on that bad boy, you know? Especially if you're playing the kind of game that's going to be more based around attacking with creatures and winning through combat damage. This is it's a very pertinent spell to just kind of bump yourself back up and undo some of that damage that your opponents put on you a little bit earlier. It deals with those kind of cuts and scrapes you often get from those early attacks from utility creatures and the like. And 10 life is just, in general, not inconsequential. And almost all of the time, you'll end up with more life than somebody else at the table. So this card has treated me very well in my Brian Stout Arm deck.
My card that I have for life gain is... actually got printed in the Commander set, and I'm really happy it did. It's called Arbiter of Nalridge, and this guy is also a giant. He is a 5/5 for 7 mana, 1 white and 6 colorless. He's actually a giant wizard. He has vigilance, and it says whenever Arbiter of Nalridge enters the battlefield, each player's life total becomes the highest life total among all players. And even though it's not pure life gain just for yourself, if you're the one that's just about to go down and someone has like a ridiculous amount of life, Arbiter Null Ridge is a great way to get yourself immediately back in the game so that you're not facing lethal damage from someone. And at the same time, you get a great body in the process. I mean, a 5-5 for 7 mana is decent, but the fact that he has Vigilance really makes me happy because I think Vigilance is probably one of the better abilities in multiplayer formats because being able to attack and defend at the same time is really great, especially for a big body like Arbiter Null Ridge has. So it's one of those cards that you can also use to save someone as well. Like if someone that you don't want to see die is about to die from someone like getting, you know, mashed to death by creatures, you can use Arbiter Null Ridge to save him because everyone's life total goes up. It's like a reverse repay in kind, exactly. It's going to keep everyone in the game, and if you're the one that's about to die, I mean, you're not going to care if everyone else is going to have a high life total. It's mainly that you care that you get a really high life total as well as having a great body in the process. So kudos to Arbiter Null Ridge.
My first life gain tech, I'm going to go with Overrule. This is an instant from Dissension. It costs X, a blue, and a white. And it just says, counter target spell unless its controller pays X, and you gain X life. There's nothing very flashy about this card. It just gets the job done. I find that it's a little sluggish because, I mean, you can't really cast it until you've got 3 mana. And even then, it's not guaranteed to counter something. But especially in the mid to late game, you just need that extra boost of life to keep you in there, to kind of keep you in that mid-range where you're not really a threat, but, you know, you're not almost dead either. This is just, I've been very happy with it in that it's extremely flexible, and if I've been wanting to slot life gain into one of my decks but can't make room, like, this pulls double duty and, you know, serves some other purpose. So, I don't know, just give it a try and see what you think.
I had never seen this card before now. But yes, I think I will actually be making use of that myself. I quite like it.
I remember playing Overrule back in the day. I agree with Donovan. It gets the job done. I mean, the life gain is just, you know, icing on the cake.
Yeah, no one's going to, like, congratulate you for your super original choice or anything. But it's pretty cool.
I guess we're back to me. And my second pick is also a one-drop. Soul Warden has been printed in about a million sets now. It's a 1/1 for 1 white, and whenever another creature comes into play, you gain a life. And I've had a lot of success with this card, granted in token decks, but when you can just play this early and people just start playing like utility creatures and it just sits on the board gaining you life, it can be very powerful. The deck that I was playing it in was a Darien King of Keldor deck who makes soldiers when you take damage, and so I would like tap a Tarnished Citadel for white mana and take 3 to make 3 guys and gain 3 life back. But even when you're not doing token shenanigans, just gaining a life whenever people play creatures is very powerful, and you can usually gain upwards of 10 life just by running this out on a pretty empty board.
Hmm. I've never really considered it in Commander, to be honest with you, but yeah, it seems like it certainly has some value. Also worth mentioning is that there's a reprint of this card. Well,
Soul's
not exactly,
Attendant.
But
no,
yeah, Soul's Attendant is basically the same thing. Okay, there's a minor difference in the wording, but it's basically the same thing. And then there's also an upgrade for 1 more mana, Aureic Champion.
It's pro-red, pro-black.
Okay, yeah.
And there's
yeah.
Suture Priest.
Yeah, Suture Priest is an interesting variant on that card as well. So there's a couple of those, so you can get some redundancy if you really like the effect. The next card that I have here is Polluted Bonds. This is an enchantment. It was a rare that was printed in Shadowmoor. It's 3 colorless and double black. Whenever a land comes into the battlefield under an opponent's control, they lose 2 life and you gain 2 life. So this is Black's version of life gain in that you're stealing it from other people, which is awesome. If you can power this out early, like with a Soul Ring, or even like I've used Dark Ritual to play it very early, This can be a very powerful card that will gain you a lot of life and do substantial damage to your opponents. If you've ever had an active Bloodchief Ascension, it's not, I'd probably say it's not quite as good as that, but in the early game, it's very strong. A lot of people ramp regardless of it, imagining that this life is inconsequential, but the fact that the life is shifting from them to you, it considerably heightens the impact that it has overall on the game. As well, it's just another nice card that hoses people that are really greedy with playing lots of ramp spells in an environment where mass land destruction is discouraged. This is one of those few cards that you can use to actually fight back against that trend.
This is going to be a card that's way out of left field, but I want to mention it because since we're kind of getting into other colors besides white, I want to talk about a red life gain spell. That's right, a red life gain spell. It actually gains you life. It's called Collapsing Borders. It's a rare out of Invasion, an enchantment that costs 4 mana, 1 red and 3 colorless. And it says, at the beginning of each player's upkeep, that player gains 1 life for each basic land type among lands he or she controls. Then Collapsing Borders deals 3 damage to him or her. So this is Red's example of life gain, to where it's life gain only if you meet certain conditions, and it happens to hurt everyone else in the process. So basically, it has the domain ability, so if you have one of each basic land type, you're going to gain 5 life and then take 3. So you're going to gain 2 life at your upkeep each time. And this is a great way to like also punish monocolor decks, because monocolor decks have no choice but to take 2 damage on each upkeep, especially since it affects everyone. And even though Collapsing Borders might be kind of a bad card, certain circumstances, Collapsing Borders can be a nice touch to like a 5-color deck that happens to reach domain. And it also double as a nice way to kind of chew away at all your opponent's life totals if they're not running a lot of basic land types. This is mainly because I want to talk about a red life gain spell.
Nice. I think Donovan's next choice is Fountain of Youth, if I'm reading this properly.
No. Although that would have been pretty sweet.
Yeah, that would have been some real secret deck right there.
If your Storm combo deck needs life gain, you might want to take a look at Fountain of Youth.
you never know. You never know.
All right, but for reals, my pick is going to be Shattered Angel.
Ooh, good pick.
Yeah,
I forgot about that.
Yeah, everyone forgets about it. It was also printed in the Commander set, but I think it was originally printed in New Phyrexia. This is a 3/3 flyer. Yeah, it costs 3 and 2 white, and it says whenever a land enters the battlefield under an opponent's control, you can gain 3 life.
Yeah.
And so I guess it's pretty similar to Polluted Bond. I mean, it has
its
pros and
cons of it.
It really depends because nicer as in like more friendly. Definitely, it dies more easily, but it's also more easily recurred, and it just gains absurd quantities of life. Like, I was playing with one of my friends, and he played this thing, and I'm just like, what is that? That's like some, you know, draft limited chaff or whatever. And then I realized, after the table goes around once, he's gained 12 life. I'm like, where is this card coming from?
What is this thing?
Yeah, I know. You look at the picture, and you definitely don't think, oh yeah, that's just going to gain him some life. Like, it's kind of scary looking.
Yeah, it definitely looks more like it's inclined to eat you.
Yeah, but, you know, gain life, maybe it wants to be your friend.
Perhaps. That is
you
a possibility.
Be its friend too.
We can all be friends with the Shattered Angel. So that's it for our life gain technology. Next, we're going to move on to the third installment of our Curving Out segment. You know my let them know. Do your thing, y'all. Keep it live.
Alright, this is our Curving Out segment. Basically, this entire segment is going to be about the 3-drop slot in your deck. We're going to talk about what our favorite 3-drops are, or maybe some hidden gems, as it were. I don't really know what else to say about this, so I'm just going to dive right into the card choices.
I like your style.
My first pick is going to be Hammer of Begarden. Alright, this Hammer was originally printed in Mirage, but it's been reprinted several times since then. It costs 1 and 2 red mana. It's a sorcery, and it just bolts something for 3. But the exciting part about it is that during your upkeep, you can pay 2 and 3 red mana to return it from your graveyard to your hand. So, I mean, you can just like randomly lock generals off the board. It fits in that spot removal slot that you really need, but you don't really feel bad, you know, I'll just say burning it on something small. Because, I mean, you can always get it back later. It just fills a pretty sweet role in any mono-red deck you want to throw it in.
Yeah, I think that it's actually a fairly, you know, usable card. A lot of people think, oh man, that's bad, it's only 3 damage. But it's like in that sweet spot that smashes utility creatures that really need to die early, like Stoneforge Mystic and especially Gaddock Teague. Like, there's only a very select group of spot removal spells you can use on him, and that's one of the really good ones.
Yeah, getting under Gaddock Teague is really huge.
I hate that little bastard with his misshapen head. You know I'm right.
And it gives you so much reach. Like, I've won several games just because you know, when it came down to things, everyone's out of gas, but I'm sitting there recurring Hammer of Begarden every turn. Mm-hmm. Like, it goes a long way.
Especially for red, and red is usually lacking recursion, other than its phoenixes.
So, yeah, this is Hammer of Begarden.
Right. Thank you, Donovan. My first pick for non-creature 3-mana cost is something you guys have heard me talk about before. It's hardly secret, but I think it's something that players should really look at, is Blood Moon. It was originally printed in the dark, and it was reprinted a couple times after that with whack white borders, and it costs 2 colorless and 1 red. And non-basic lands are mountains. It's an enchantment. So it's sweet to the point, and you know what? It does exactly what you want it to do, because if you're in a deck where you feel like you're losing because your opponents are outspending you on their mana base, this one card may remedy a lot of your problems. Especially as metagames advance and non-basic counts become much higher, the effect of Blood Moon scales appropriately and it becomes more and more devastating, to the point where sometimes playing it literally leaves your opponents unable to answer it. I know a lot of people will say, oh, well, then maybe they should build better decks. Yeah, well, maybe they just also didn't happen to draw the appropriate cards to enable them to get rid of the Blood Moon. Like, in games, lots of things happen. Mono-red decks are consistently looked down upon. A lot of people think that they're just worse than their counterparts and all the other colors and the multicolor and so on. But being under the effect of a really devastating Blood Moon will show people just how good red can be if you're willing to cast off some of the mores that are associated with Commander. This is not a socially pleasant card. Not in all situations, anyway. I think it's not that bad, personally, because my man Sinus, a.k.a. Imshan, he said once very eloquently that basically your opponents have to give you explicit permission to destroy them with Blood Moon. Like, you lose from Blood Moon because of choices that you have made. And you can choose not to make Blood Moon as bad by just using more basic lands. And I think that makes it completely fair. I'd use it pretty much anywhere. I think that it's a totally fair card. It's not like a mass land destruction thing either. It's just some mana denial. It curbs the game a little bit. I think that's fine. I think it should go well in most groups. In some, they won't like it, and in that context, it's fine. But it's a very powerful 3-mana spell. Its power is very often disproportionate to its cost.
Yeah, you can also alleviate the damage that it does to your deck by just skipping land drops, which we already learned.
I think we've been over the wisdom of not playing lands. Yeah, most definitely. Yeah. And that card, again, for everyone playing along at home, that was Blood Moon. So, Carlos?
My first pick is Primal Growth. It's a common from Planeshift that costs 2 and a green. It is a sorcery with kicker, sacrifice a creature, and you search your library for a basic land and put that into play untapped, and then shuffle your library. If you paid the kicker, then you get to search for 2 basic lands instead and put them into play untapped. This thing... At first, I only played it in a Wart the Raid Mother deck that was just trying to trigger Valakut a million times. But then I started playing it in other decks like Donovan's Child of Valar deck that's all commons. And this thing is just good all the time. Putting lands into play untapped makes it more relevant later in the game, and it ramps you from 3 to 5, which is a lot better than people give it credit for. And, like, you can play Eternal Witness and then Primal Growth and sacrifice your Eternal Witness or something like that. You always have extra guys that you don't mind sacrificing to ramp up 2 lands, and they're untapped. It's a lot better than a lot of the other ramp spells that I see people running, and I'll frequently run it over something like Cultivator Kadama's Reach.
Yeah, this joint is hot. Use it with Reassembling Skeleton in a Savor deck. Oh, God, the taste is just so delicious. Because you can do it on the third turn, sacrifice the skeleton, and then just bring the skeleton back. It's such a great feeling.
Or Blood Gas, so it just comes back by itself.
Yep, double up. I love that. Yeah, I really like this card. This is one I've been using for a while, and I don't know if I would necessarily run it over the more like traditional ramp spells necessarily, but it's a lot better than Haro. Like, a lot better. I can't really see any reason to use it, unless you're like playing a basically creatureless deck. I'd pretty much prefer this all the time.
The first card I like is Propaganda. And if you don't know what Propaganda is, it is a uncommon out of Tempest. It got reprinted in Commander. It's a blue enchantment that costs 1 blue and 2 colorless. And it says creatures can't attack you unless the attacking player pays 2 mana for each creature that's attacking you. And the cost gets paid as attackers are declared. And as I said in my legendary plays about Windborn Muse and how the fact that's basically a propaganda on a body because it's the exact same thing, propaganda effects are really good attack deterrents, and especially against tokens, because there is usually someone that likes to run a token deck like Soulsphere Wolfblood or Hazion Tamar or some deck that likes to crab out a ton of tokens and give them an overrun effect to kill everyone. Propaganda is a great way to save your bacon, especially with a resource that most people don't really care about like too much in a vacuum, but then they do like in the context of the game. Because like propaganda slows down someone if they want to attack you. So if they want to actually attack you, they physically have to put in effort to take you out. And I really like that because they usually want to do something else, and especially if they're attacking with multiple creatures, 2 mana per creature really adds up. And propaganda has been a mainstay in both constructed formats, multiplayer formats, and it has definitely made a transition over to Commander. Propaganda, great card. Ghostly Prison as well, the white version of it. Love it as well. Long story short, propaganda is awesome.
Okay, so we'll cycle back to Donovan, and now we're going to be talking about creatures.
All right, so my pick for the creature slot is going to be Chandra's Phoenix. This is another red card. I mean, it's out of the same deck, so we'll just roll with it. It was just printed in M12. It's a 2/2 flyer, cost 1 and 2 red. It has haste, and whenever an opponent is dealt damage by a red instant or sorcery you control, or by a red planeswalker you control, you get to return Chandra's Phoenix from your graveyard to your hands. So it's kind of like Hammer of Begarden in that it gives you that little bit of extra reach, but it can also combo with Hammer of Begarden. It's just pretty all-around useful, especially for mono-red decks that are really lacking that extra card advantage you really need. But one of the things I like about Chandra's Phoenix the most is, I mean, it's just a little dinky creature, but it carries equipment like a champ. Like, it can just hop out of your graveyard at any moment and strap on, like, that sort of Feast and Famine or whatever sitting out there that people think they're safe from. I haven't had a lot of time to play with it, but I've been pretty happy with it so far.
Yeah, it seems good to me. I was kind of wondering, actually, how useful that would ultimately be, but especially with the hammer, that seems very good. Okay, so my creature's pick, that's going to be Preacher. This is a card from the dark. It costs 1 colorless and double white, and it's a human cleric now, which is unfortunate. It used to be just straight-up summon Preacher, which was way more ballin'. I've talked about Preacher before on the cast. This guy just is the total package. You may choose not to untap Preacher during your untap step, and then you can tap him, and you gain control of target creature of an opponent's choice that they control for as long as he stays tapped. So he's tapped, he's sermonizing, your opponent has to pick one of their creatures, and then they get biblicized by this biblical beast, and he joins your team. I think that's pretty sweet. He's a 1/1, so he dies to a stiff wind, but hey, we can't all be perfect. Now, the best things about Preacher, other than the fact that it's actually a very effective card to play early in the game and in the late game, it's solid at 3 mana at any phase of the game, is the sideburns. Like, he has some really impeccable sideburns. He also just looks fucking pissed. Like, this thing is doing his thug thizzle. Like, this is an old-timey
Preacher. I'm about ready to give you a sermon that you won't forget.
Exactly. Like, he could be a WWE character. I don't know. I would like to know. But, yeah, this guy, don't fuck around. Like, new clerics, they don't have shit on Preacher. Preacher is shown, like, Transcendent Master thinks he's all enlightened and shit. Do you see this guy? The pure rage. Like, I think people actually just hook up with him because he's so angry and they're like, you know, I just don't want to deal with this right now. It's easier to fight with him than against him, you know? It's like a really stubborn old man.
Dude, this is just begging for a Sharpie altar, you know?
Looks
like he's about to whip out a shotgun.
It looks like he's going to beat you to death with his bare hands / sideburns is what's going to happen.
Get off my lawn, you hooligans.
Yeah, exactly. Get off my religion, you know? But, yeah, I wouldn't want to alter it because it's from the dark, and they're actually kind of hard to find sometimes, so... Is this a reprintable card? I think so. The new art would probably be super whack because it's pretty hard to match Quentin Hoover in general. And this thing's a masterpiece. Like, look at the brows too. Oh my god, the eyebrows. Those are so ballin'. Anyway, Preacher, solid card. Put it in your decks. Next card.
All right, I guess I'm next. My pick is Adamaro, First to Desire. Ooh. It's a rare from Saviors of Kamigawa for 1 and double red, and its power and toughness is equal to the number of cards in the hand of the opponent with the most cards in their hand. And I actually built a deck with This is the General at one point, and then took it apart because people hated playing against it, because you kill at least 2 people by, like, turn 5. I mean, think about the games that you've played. There's always someone with at least 7 cards, if there isn't the guy with Reliquary Tower and, like, 12 cards in their hand. And so this guy is just gigantic and doesn't cost very much no matter how many times they destroy it. And, I mean, I guess having a gigantic beatstick as your general isn't that exciting, but it's still pretty awesome to just be like, Mountain, Rite of Flame, remove Simeon Spirit Guide, Adamaro, go.
Wow. That would be pretty awesome to get.
That's what that deck did. It just, like, tried to turbo out Adamaro by turn 1 or 2 and then beat people to death and see what happened. It was so much fun.
Yeah, like you're saying, I don't know how exciting it would be to have, like, just a giant beater as your general, unless it's coming out on the first turn, in which case it's pretty fucking awesome.
I mean, he's a lot better than he gets credit for. He's still not awesome because he is a vanilla beatstick, but if he's your general, like,
he's
3 hits
wings.
Minimum, and, I mean, he also just looks crazy.
I was going to say, he also has, like, an entourage
the nice thing about
floating heads, so...
The nice thing about Adamaro is that he's constantly checking who has the greatest number of cards in someone's hand. So, like, let's say someone has, like, a huge grip of cards, and then they get Identity Crisis'd out, and they lose their entire hand. Adamaro will just count who has the next highest amount of cards in their hand. So he never is in danger of dying that way, which is pretty slick.
He lets you justify playing cards like Howling Mine, which are awesome for red because you don't have other cards and are just kind of hilarious.
He seems really strong, too, with the draw sevens that red has, like that everyone discard and draw. That seems like it would be surprisingly good with him. So, yes. And he's also smoking out of his spine, which is a unique skill.
Might want to get that checked out.
Yeah, probably not. It's probably even less healthy than regular smoking. Okay.
My pick is Yavimaya Dryad. And Yavimaya Dryad is a green creature that's an uncommon out of Time Spiral. It costs 2 green and 1 colorless. It is a 2/1. It has Forest Walk. And when it enters the battlefield, you may search your library for a forest card, and you put it onto the battlefield tapped under target player's control. And if you do, you shuffle your library. And Yavimaya Dryad is just one of those ramp spells that I really like because it gives you a body and it ramps you at the same time. You're basically paying 1 more mana for essentially rampant growth, even though it's not exactly rampant growth, but you're basically getting a decent body. And the Forest Walk is actually really relevant because considering green is really good in Commander now, there's bound to be at least one person running forests, and it's a great way to just, you know, strap equipment onto her and have her, you know, have the Forest Walk come into play. And in a pinch, you can give someone who's not playing green a forest of your own. So, like, very late in the game when you don't care about another forest, but you care about the Yavimaya Dryad being unblockable, you can just donate him one of your forests, and you can start swinging through with the Yavimaya Dryad, which is kind of cool. It's one of those cheap creatures that I am not ashamed of running at all, and I run it in almost every single green deck I play. It's called Yavimaya Dryad.
We're going to cycle back to Donovan for our last miscellaneous card at the 3-drop slot.
All right. I just want to say I have, like, a very bittersweet relationship with the 3-drop slot, because all the really interesting things start to happen at 3 mana, so the decks I try to build just get, like, crammed full of all these 3-drops, and it's so awkward to play. Like, I find that the more 2-drops and stuff I have in my decks, usually the smoother it runs. But, I mean, 3-drops are very important. And I just wanted to give a shout-out to, like, probably one of my secret favorite 3-drops of all time. This guy's Drift of Phantasms. This is a common from Ravnica. It costs 2 and a blue for a 0/5 flying defender if you actually want to cast it. But, I mean, more importantly, it's got Transmute, which is awesome. It costs 1 and 2 blue to transmute it, and that just basically means you get to discard it from your hand to shoot tutor up anything in your deck that has the same converted mana cost. So if your deck is, like, jam-packed with 3-drops, like most of my decks tend to end up, then he's just very good utility. He's easy to recur, he's easy to tutor up, just a very important link in the chain. I love Drift of Phantasms, and I hope it'll be my friend.
Nice.
Well said.
Yeah, that was a nice positive spin at the end. I like it. Okay, so to take things the wrong way, mine is Sudden Death, where you lose friends at instant speed. So Sudden Death is an uncommon from Time Spiral. It's an instant. It costs 1 colorless and double black. And the card text is split second, which is awesome immediately. Target creature gets -4/-4 until end of turn. Now, interesting, it does not kill Drift of Phantasms, so it can't end that friendship. But this will end a lot of friendships. Your friendship with Gaddock Teague will end. And that's one of the more important ones. I was talking about that earlier when we were talking about the Hammerable Garden. Sudden Death is a fantastic piece of spot removal. There are so many cards you want to kill, but you don't want to use a sweeper to kill them. Sudden Death is one of the best pieces of spot removal for cards that generally fall into that category. The really dangerous cards that are a little lower on the curve. Like Kiki Jiki is another similar card that you cannot feel ashamed of burning a Sudden Death on. That's a great use for it. That's the kind of card that you have this in the deck for. In Ghetto Situation as well, you can just use it to like save yourself from lethal general damage. You can use it to politic. But at Split Second as well is key. In a lot of decks where they're running very powerful like Sacrifice Outwits that tend to be creature-based, it's not as good against the ones that are on the lands. But otherwise, this is a very powerful card that ducks a lot of the kind of runarounds you get to trying to use spot removal. Can't be countered, which is fantastic. Well, countered by most means, it can't be. Yeah, it's just a very solid card. I'd really recommend using it. In most of your decks that have black mana and can generate double up earlier in the game, why not? I think it's probably better than a lot of the other common spot removal you see used.
All right, so my third pick is Realms Uncharted. It's a green instant from Rise of the Eldrazi for 2 and a green, and you search your library for 4 land cards with different names, and an opponent chooses 2 of them. The 2 cards go to your graveyard, and the rest go to your hand. This has been pretty absurd for me, mostly because my piles include 2 good lands, Petrified Field and Talaria West, but the ability to just, like, go get a bunch of utility lands, or go get, like, a bunch of cycling lands, or... I mean, every deck should be running some number of utility lands and ways to get them back, like Crucible of Worlds or whatever. You can do so many things that are just positive value with this, like Buried Ruin. There's so many utility lands over the history of the game that you can do something powerful with this in just about any green deck, and I've never been disappointed with it.
Yeah, I think that you can go the recursion route with this, but I think one of its stronger points is just its flexibility, because, I mean, it can fix mana, or... you can just go grab a bunch of cycling lands if you need to draw cards, like you said. If you need to blow up a land, you can just search up, you know, Wasteland, Strip Mine, Dust Bowl.
Strip Mines.
Like, there's so, pretty much, just because there's so much redundancy in a lot of the utility lands. If you're getting beat down by a dude, you can go get Prov, Spires of Order, Corehaven, and Maze of Ith. Like, you pretty much get your way, and it's just a good all-around utility spell for a variety of situations.
What was that card again, Carlos, in case anyone was unfamiliar?
Realms Uncharted is the card.
Okay, so my miscellaneous card is called Recross the Paths. It is a uncommon out of Morningtide. It's a sorcery. It's green. 2 colorless and 1 green for 3 mana. You reveal cards from the top of your library until you reveal a land card, and you put that card onto the battlefield and the rest on the bottom of your library in any order. Then you clash with an opponent, and if you win, you return Recross the Paths to its owner's hand. And if you don't know what Clash is, you just reveal the top of your library, and whoever has the highest converted mana cost wins the Clash. And if it's a tie, then no one wins. And I really like Recross the Paths because it's one of those ramp spells that if you get lucky a couple times, it can generate some pretty serious card advantage. And the cool thing about Recross the Paths is that it can put non-basic lands into play. Like, a lot of ramp spells that in green that most people play... stuff like Explosive Vegetation, Kodama's Reach, and Cultivate, they only get basic lands. So being able to get non-basic lands off Recross the Paths is a pretty nice bonus. And since the land also comes into play untapped, if you have something else that turn, you get the ramp and you get the untapped land. So it's not too much of a difference in terms of like if you want to still do something in that game. Or that turn, I should say. Yeah, I mean, at the very least, it's going to get rid of a land that you don't want to top deck next turn. And at the best case scenario, it's going to let you play this card a couple times and get some pretty good card advantage. And again? That card is called Recross the Paths.
So that's it for curving out at converted mana cost of 3. Next season, I think we'll be going up to 4 if we're going to be following. Like, who knows? Maybe we'll just throw a curveball. We're going up to 9. What are your staples at 9 converted mana cost? But
Grows off.
Yeah, but probably 4. I can't make any guarantees, though. But that's it for our technology segment this week. So we're going to go into the season finale. that rounds out CommanderCast Season 3, Episode 13, and that also rounds out Season 3 as a whole. That was one hell of a season, if I do say so myself. I think probably our best yet. It's pretty much off the chain. We had a lot of good guests, a lot of good insight, I'd like to think, probably mostly from you guys, but whatever. So that's going to be the end of CommanderCast.blogspot.com as well. I want to really emphasize that. Next, we're moving to CommanderCast.com. We have our own site. It's going to be totally ballin'. It's got all kinds of sweet
features. No more Blogspot.
No, oh my god. This is
no
so
more Blogspot.
No, no more of that garbage. Like, you're not going to bleed out of the eyes anymore when you look at the page. There's going to be a reasonable comment area where you can leave comments through multiple mediums. So I think that's going to be a significant improvement. Many people have commented that they don't like our comments area, and neither do I. It's just what we got with Blogspot.
It's
so hard to use. Oh my god, like, I'm logging into my Gmail account, and it makes me like jump through so many hoops to like actually get something posted.
Yeah.
Oh my god.
Yeah, it is what it is, but no longer. We will no longer have to worry about that. So the new website will have all the old content ported onto it. It's going to be way easier to sort through. If you want, like, let's say you're reading one of, like, Breon's articles, and you want to see, oh, okay, I kind of like these, let's check out what else she has. There's one link that you can click on, and it shows you everything else she's ever done. There's going to be the updated content index. Everything's just going to be a lot easier to navigate as well. I'm assuming it's going to run better on most computers, and as well, our articles will now have card tags. So you can just mouse over and see what cards the author is referring to. Those won't be in the old articles, because I'm not going to go back and port them into the thousands upon thousands of words that have been written, but the new article should be consistent as far as those go. So I think that will be one of the most significant improvements as far as the new site goes. I'm really looking forward to it. I hope it lives up to everybody's expectations, but that placeholder image is a really tough act to follow. People have really liked that. But we're going to go on to the usual 3-week break. So we will be back in 3 weeks with more of the same. I hope that's okay. But if the feedback means anything that I've been getting so far, people will definitely be happy with more of the same. But September, we will be returning with more community strategy and technology. Anything that you guys want to throw out before we finish this one up? Because I have a lot to say before this actually ends. There's a lot of people to thank. And yet you ungrateful bastards have no one to thank. Fresh. Okay. So, yeah, on the way out, a lot of people have contributed to the success of the show over the last, 6 months, 8 months kind of thing. And I never really expected things to get to this phase. So that's pretty awesome for something that happened on one specific weekend because I had nothing better to do. So first and foremost, I'd like to thank everyone that does a podcast with me, obviously. All my co-hosts, the ones that are on, the ones that aren't on right now. You guys know who you are. You guys are awesome. And without you, this podcast would be fucking terrible. So that is pretty rad that you guys actually warp around my extremely strange schedule as well, because I know that's a pain in the ass for you guys. But we make it work, and I think that that's beautiful, for me especially, obviously. I definitely benefit the most from that. But outside that, we also have all of our authors, and I'd like to thank you guys for just contributing to the whole CommanderCast scheme, because originally this was just a podcast, and now it's like, I want to call it a multimedia kingdom, because it's definitely not an empire. But, you know, we've got everything going on there. We got the articles, we got videos, we got podcasts, and there's going to be a lot more as well. There's some new people joining the team, who I will mention now. Imshan, like I said, and Fred, who you've seen a couple of his articles now if you've been checking the midweek updates and the Friday flashbacks, they're going to be taking some full-time spots, whatever that will entail, on the new CommanderCast.com, as well Sean Patchen from Red Sight Wins. He's been somebody that I've been talking with a lot about Commander lately. He's agreed to write some articles for us as well, so he'll be taking in also a regular authorship spot. I'd also like to definitely thank Randy and Connor. These are two people, if you're listening to the podcast, you may have never heard of them before. I did write about them on the last Friday flashback, though, when I was thanking people that contributed to the show. They've been huge contributors. Connor is a sound guy, and he proof listens to the podcast very consistently, and he does a fantastic job. And I didn't know this is like his job. He's like a professional. He does it for free, which is pretty ballin'. And Randy is the same. Randy is an editor. He goes over the articles and makes sure that they're in good shape. And he does a job of it that I couldn't fathom doing because he literally uses terms I did not know were associated with English. So obviously he's kind of on some next level shit as far as that goes. And that's also like his profession. So I can't thank those guys enough for donating time to my hobby website. That's really awesome. Like, what can I say? It's not like I can pay them. So they're just doing it because I guess they like it. And that's really awesome. I've got a team of people that do this for really no tangible benefit. I also want to thank Chris Otwell, like I did in the article. for running MTGcast, because without MTGcast, most of you probably never would have heard of this podcast. And I think that's the same thing with a lot of podcasts on that network. Like, who would know about any of these podcasts if it weren't for MTGcast? That's where you go to get Magic podcasts. And that's just awesome that he does that for us. But then there's a whole bunch of other people that have been super helpful as well. I want to thank Luke Saunier. I really hope I'm pronouncing that right, but I'm probably not. Luke writes articles on GatheringMagic.com. It's called Cast Through Time. And in it, he analyzes podcasts related to Magic that have come out over a given week. And he has been incredibly pleasant to Commander Cast. He sent us a huge number of new listeners for absolutely no personal gain. So I just want to thank him for speaking so highly of us all the time. It's really helped us out. It's gotten us a lot of new listeners. And yeah, he's just been really awesome about that. As well, I want to thank Benny Smith and Sean McCallum both, because they've both been linking to us from StarCityGames.com, which is a website some of you may have heard of. And that's been really awesome of them, because like, I don't tell anyone to do that. They just do it. And that's great. Like, that helps us grow a lot as well. It brings a lot of people to the site that have probably never heard of it before, because not everyone listens to podcasts. Even though MTGcast is a huge deal, not everyone goes to it. And this gives the people a little direction to our own site as well, commandercast.blogspot.com. So they got to see these articles that people were producing. And as well, in the same category, I want to thank Cassidy Silver, who was on the podcast this season when we were talking about Mono Green. Cassidy is like one of my mans. We dialogue back and forth all the time. And he runs You Can't Handle the Nath as well. And he's linking to us all the time on tcgplayer.com, also known as Brainburst, which is another website a lot of you are probably familiar with. And that's really awesome of him to do that, because, you know, again, it's not like I asked him to or anything. He just does it. So that's pretty sick. So next season is going to be huge. On top of CommanderCast.com, we have an enormous list of guests that are going to be appearing. We're going to be doing something called Crossover Month, where throughout that month, you're going to have all kinds of material from other websites appearing on ours, and ours will be appearing on theirs to give some people some exposure, that kind of thing. But outside that, here's just like a little glimpse into the future in terms of guests that we've got. And this is like the only time you'll ever really hear me name dropping, I guess, but I'm going to do it. Fuck it. Whatever. So we got Sean Patchen from Red Sight Wins, Benny Smith from StarCityGames.com, Omar Hernandez of Twitter fame, Jay Boosh and Scotty Mack, both bros from the A-Team, Frank Richard, I think I'm saying that properly. He's Quebecois, and he has like the most awesome voice ever, and he's from Crazy Talk. Luke Saunier from Cast Through Time, Chris Lansdell, my homie. He's from Horde of Notions and every other podcast on MTGcast. Dave Lee, a.k.a. Durfington, the author of Dirtling Around and local homie. Sean McCowan, another StarCityGames.com author. And we're going to have Uriah from CMDR Decks on. So we have a lot of guests next season already lined up. And I think these are people have wanted to hear from. I've gotten a couple, most of these are from requests. So I'm really looking forward to that. I hope you guys are too. Just remember, big time, CommanderCast.com. No more Blogspot shit. So I know that was a lot of people to thank at the end of the podcast. And again, I want to thank everyone just for listening. During the break, feel free to email us, tweet at us, leave comments wherever, and suggest things that you'd like to see either on the new website or on the show for the fourth season. That's it for season 3. We got it in the can. Season 4 coming up. Big things coming down the pipeline. Hopefully you will all return in 3 weeks when we kick off season 4.
Let's get it!